Parshas Vayishlach, and the spirit of Chanukah is in the air already. You're hearing pre-Chanukah shiurim, people are pulling their Chanukah svarim off the shelves, people are buying presents for the children. Parshas Vayishlach always coalesces with Chanukah. And it's not a coincidence. As the Shla writes, when a given parsha corresponds to a given season of the year, there is always a correlation, because there are no coincidences in the Olam HaRuchni. And the truth is, Parshas Vayishlach is brimming with Ramazim to Chanukah. Let's trace a few of them. When Yaakov, in his trepidation of Esav, sends Esav a tribute, and then is preparing for the showdown. And in the dark of night, amidst that fright, he has his family cross the river. While Yaakov goes back, Yaakov forgot something. And that is when the Sarashal Esav attacks him, Esav's Malach. What did he forget? Chazal say, pachim katanim, small vessels. Well, that term pach is a pretty infrequent term. We also find it, that term pachim, jugs, regarding Chanukah, that there was a pach, there was a jug of pure oil, which had the signature of the Kohen Gadol, the Chosam Shel Kohen Gadol. Shla and others see this as a correlation, that Yahu's pach and katanim are some sort of remes to the pach shemen of the Kohen Gadol. And the reason why that is so significant is it's more than simply pach, pach, the term appearing. Is let's appreciate in this context, Sarashal Esav attacks him. Now, Sarashal Esav, as much as Esav is not Yavan, is not the nemesis of Chanukah, but according to the Maharal, Esav is a klali force, is an umbrella force of all the four Galias, Bavel, Parasumada, Yavan, and then, of course, Edom itself. So then Sarashal Esav's attack on Yaakov, in his quest to find Pachim Ketanim, takes on a certain power and gravitas to it. The power of Galus, Esav as the general power of Galus, in the particular Yavon iteration, is fighting with the Jewish people as they grope and look for the appropriate Pach, in this case, the Pach Shema Munach B'chos Mashakon Galus. And this parallel becomes even more intriguing when we appreciate that when the Sarashal Esav attacks Yaakov, and Yaakov is largely immune, he is unable to hurt Yaakov and inflict any sort of malady or disease upon Yaakov. However, he afflicts him in the yerech, in the thigh, in the area of the Gerhanasha, which symbolically represents that area of vulnerability which the Klal Yisrael has to Esav, or whatever Koach of Galus, Yavan, Paras, they like. Well, the Medrash tells us, a Medrash cited by the Ramban, that his inflicting of a wound in the Yerach represents Doro Shel Shmad, the generation of Shmad, the generation where the enemies of Klal Yisrael try to lead them to abandon mitzvahs by subjecting them to cruel torture and punishment if they don't give up their way of life. Well, that term, Doros Shel Shmad, is exactly what happened at the time of Chanukah, in this generation where their goal was not to murder us and kill us like in the generation of Purim, but rather their goal was Shmad, to have us abandon Yiddishkeit. So here we have Shmad, the Chanukah challenge, surfacing in the context of Yaakov being attacked when he looks for a pach, foreshadowing the pach shel Kohen Gadol. So this is a meaningful pattern in itself, albeit we have to dig deeper. What is the deeper meaning? Why Yaakov's pach and katanim, Yaakov's jugs are taking on this foreshadowing meaning in terms of the Chanukah story, and Shmad in this story, and Shmad in that story? But we're still in detective mode. We are not yet ready to explain what patterns represent. Let's continue in this parasha to trace the Hanukkah patterns. Yaakov finally acquires land in Eretz Yisrael at a place called Shechem, and we all know what happens there. Dina is abducted. Now there is very clear indication linking the abduction of Dina to the story of Hanukkah. One indication I would bring out is from the Medrash. The Medrash tells us that Yaakov had four challenges, real sufferings and tribulations in his life. Running away for his life from Esav, his brother seeks to kill him, number one. Number two, the difficult father-in-law, love and family issues he has to deal with in last week's parsha. Number three, his daughter was abducted, Dina. And number four, Yosef. Yosef would be abducted and sold down to Mitzrayim. Yaakov's four great challenges, which all correspond to a given pasuk, lo shalvesi, lo shakadati, lo hinachti, vayavarokis. Well, in another medrash, the same pasuk regarding four challenges, lo shalvesi, lo shakadati, lo hinachti, vayavarokis, is correlated to the four exiles of the Jewish people, which from an intertextual Midrashic study would imply, yeah, the same source is cited for four tragedies of Yaakov, four tragedies of Jewish people, because in fact, Yaakov's four tribulations foreshadow Maisa Avosim Labanim, the four Galuyos of Klal Yisrael, which makes sense. And when you align the four and the four, it emerges clearly that the third challenge of Yaakov, his daughter being abducted, corresponds to Galus Yavon. And it's not only a intermidrashic, intertextual pattern, but it's intriguing within itself to think of it this way. Yaakov's daughter was violated and abducted, which is exactly what happened at the time of the story of Hanukkah, when the Yavanim decreed that every Jewish girl must spend the night with the Hegemon, with the Greek general, prior to getting married. And not only were the Jewish women violated just like Dina, but who were they violated by? The prince or the general, the hegemon, just like Dina was violated by Shechem, who was the Nasi Haaretz, the prince of the land. And not only that, just like in the story of Hanukkah, where the Hashmonaim took up arms, Shimon and Levi took up arms. And of course, Levi, one of those who took arms here, is the ancestor of the Hashmonaim. And Medrash links the Hashmonaim back to their ancestor Levi and the bracha to Levi, the bracha and bezos ha-bracha which Moshe gives Levi. All very powerful, all very significant, especially when you read the words of Shimon and Levi, when they say, Hakazona ye asachosenu, we're not going to allow our sister to become a harlot. Well, in the story of Hanukkah, many sources tell us that what provoked the Hashmonaim was when one of their sisters said, I am about to be violated, and a very provocative scene. She stimulated her brothers to take arms in an unmistakable corollary to Achazonius Asahoseno. So here we have clues galore, that not only Yaakov's Pach and Ketanim correspond to the Pach Shemen, but the violation of Dina in this parsha corresponds to the story of Hanukkah. And it's intriguing, just as we were intrigued or perplexed why the jugs of Yaakov, the Pach and Ketanim are so significant, it's intriguing in this story as well that the violation of Dina, or the violation of the Jewish girl in the Hanukkah story, which seems like one aspect of the miracle of Hanukkah, is being so highlighted and showcased here. Clearly, the violation of the Jewish girl somehow symbolizes the entire struggle with the Yavanim, and how powerful from this perspective when we appreciate that the heroine of the story of Hanukkah, one of the heroines anyway, was Yehudis. She was one of these girls who fought back the Greek aggressor, and Yehudis is the feminine of Yehuda. Yehuda is, of course, the name of the masculine hero in the Hanukkah story, and the very Midah of Hanukkah, which we are taught as the Midah of Hodah, the Midah of Thanksgiving, that it seems that there is a feminine corollary to Yehuda, and that is Yehudis, and the violation of the Jewish girl is not a detail in the story, but as central as the masculine battle being waged upon the battlefield, which all points to the power of this Ramazan, our parsha, the abduction of Dina is the foreshadowing of the Hanukkah story. So to make a long story short, Vayishlach is indeed a pre-Hanukkah parsha. And it makes sense. It makes sense when you think of it from the following perspective. While most of the four exiles, the four Goliaths, are exiles literally, in terms of being exiled from our land, or at least we are under a foreign government in a foreign land, Bavel, Parasumadai, Golis Adom, we're an exiled people under foreign domination, the story of Hanukkah happens in Eretz Yisrael. There's a foreign kingdom in Eretz Yisrael. We're not in a foreign country. It's a different type of galus, and why that is significant is Parshas Vayishlach is the parsha of Yaakov's tribulations in Eretz Yisrael. Last week's parsha, Parshas Vayetze, his running away from Esav and his struggles with love and happening in Chutz La'aretz. Likewise, next week's parsha, Vayeshev and Miketz, which follows, is the story of Yosef being sold down to Mitzrayim, right, corresponding to the other exiles which happened in Chutz La'aretz. Vayishlach, on the other hand, is now showcased so well and so snugly as the story of Hanukkah, because it is the story of Yaakov's trials and tribulations in Eretz Yisrael, because Yaakov has largely entered Eretz Yisrael, as Rashi said in the end of last week's parsha, when he met up with Mahanaim, two camps of angels. The angels and the divine protection of Chutz La'aretz is leaving him, and now he has the more intimate protection through the Malachim and the greater Hashgach in Eretz Yisrael. He's in Eretz Yisrael now, yet still he struggles. This is exactly the story of Hanukkah. Now that we can embrace Vayishlach as a Hanukkah parsha, we want to be able to tease out its deeper meaning. And why specifically these things? The Pachim Ketanim of Yaakov, the violation of his daughter. Why are these the most glorified and showcased aspects of Hanukkah to merit this foreshadowing? So let's delve deeper into the entire culture camp, the entire struggle which Klal Yisrael has with Yavam. I would argue that Yavan is a culture of visualization, seeing things, and making sense out of things. It's a culture which glorified aesthetic beauty. In fact, Yavan, as a descendant of Yefes in the Chumash, which is Milushin, Yofi, Noach's son, Yefes, was seen as the progenitor of Greek culture and Western culture. Yefes, Milosh, and Yofi. Yes, it is a culture of all about beauty. They glorified beauty. They glorified symmetry in engineering. We know some of their great buildings still exist. Their great structures exist till this very day in Athens. And you see the perfect symmetry of their various structures, their beauty in art, and really their beauty in terms of thought process. The rational thought process, Chachma, as Maral calls it, is a Yavan creation. It's all about man's ability to make sense out of things, to see things, to give boundaries and conceptualizations to things. Which on one hand is a very elevating, even ennobling to the human conditions. The human being is a being of chachma, a being who understands things, a being who can carefully map out things, can take the concept of abstraction and high beautiful ideas, but ideas which are elevated, and give them visualization and artistic expression. On one hand, that's a very, very powerful idea, but it's a very limiting idea. Because ultimately, nothing truly meaningful can be fully understood or comprehended. Certainly not divine concepts and Jewish concepts. And it's even true about great human concepts. Does love really make sense? Can you really define love? Does happiness have a clear A plus B equals C definition? No, it doesn't. Because anything truly meaningful defies the rational. I'll never forget my Rebbe Reb Ezra Neuberger, who was just Nifter and who's been mourned by an entire community in Eretz Yisrael of Baltimore and beyond. He would oftentimes say, we all know the famous statement attributed to Reb Chaim Brisker, that if you can't explain something, you don't understand it. But he said, you know what's also true? If you could totally explain a concept in Torah, it means you're superficial. Because as far as we get an understanding of something in Torah, in life, something meaningful, it really transcends the ability to explain it, to give clear quantification to it. And this is the danger of Yavan. And it's the danger of trying to take the divine and make it too rational, bring it down. And when you bring something down, you demystify it. We know in the laws of intimacy, halachas of relationship as well, there are certain laws of tznius to ensure one never sees everything in their partner. And this is to maintain the magic, the mystique, right? The soul-like quality to that which is most precious, that which is most beautiful. And certainly it is that way with Hashem. The Greeks have no concept of the metaphysical, which is why their gods were all seen as Herculean sort of figures. Think of Greek mythology. The notion that the divine really transcends physicality, that doesn't make sense to a Greek mind, because a Greek mind is all about giving physical dimensions, physical understanding to something. Even the divine has to be something which is really human, just Superman-ish. And not only having a body, but we all know in Greek mythology, all the gods and the goddesses have all sorts of human foibles and jealousies and rivalries and so forth, right? Because the notion that ultimate meaning transcends and is transcendent is foreign to Greek consciousness. And this is why they have such a difficult time with Klal Yisrael. Suddenly there is this people who they're resisting our efforts at Hellenism, our efforts to glorify their culture, because that's what the Greeks did. The Greeks had a respect towards local cultures. They would invade a country, and they would seek to find a way for the local culture and religion to be glorified by everything Greek. And initially, towards Klal Yisrael as well, they were fascinated by Torah. Alexander the Great himself had deep respect toward Shimon HaTzadok, as the Gemara tells us, the Jewish leader, and his ear, so to speak, one of the Greek dynasties, the dynasty of Talmai, they wanted to translate the Torah because they were deeply interested in Torah. They wanted to give greater accessibility to Torah, but the Jews are resisting this because the Jews understand that our Torah is metaphysical, is magical, and it will lose its mystique if it is Hellenized. And that is, of course, the deeper meaning of the entire culture kampf. Yavan does not destroy the oil and the Torah, which oil represents. They are metame. They defile the oil. The notion of the metaphysical therein, they are unable to deal with. And I think in this regard, oftentimes, of what the Ramban writes about Aristotle. He speaks in very, castigates Aristotle in very demeaning words. This man who cannot deal with that which his senses could not sense, right? Aristotelian philosophy, Greek philosophy, for all of its virtues, and we all know that Rambam was enamored with many aspects of the Aristotelian way of thinking. But at the end of the day, the Ramban says it is so deficient in its inability to deal with that which transcends human senses. And that is why when the Greeks translated Torah, when the Talmai, when the Talmudic Greek dynasty translated Torah, we're taught there were 3 days of Choshech in the world, 3 days of darkness. You think you're bringing light, you think you're bringing enlightenment and opening up Torah, but you're really bringing great darkness. Because the more you try to make sense of that which we can't make sense of, the more you demystify it. I think in this regard of lights, think of neo-disco lights in Manhattan or a similar place, which totally obscure the beautiful nighttime sky. And something of greater beauty becomes obscured by a human creation of so-called beauty, so-called art, which is drowning out the real art. And that's a perfect muscle for what the Greeks are doing. And the deeper meaning of the Medrash and Bereishis, which tells us of the four expressions of primordial chaos in the world at the time of creation, va'aretz ha'sov, va'vov, va'choshech al pnei sahom, choshech, darkness, corresponds to Yavan, because it's a supposedly enlightened culture, but it's speaking about the greatest choshech, so paradoxically and ironically, a culture which doesn't claim to be enlightening. They don't challenge the Ar HaTorah and the notion that there is something transcendent. It is only a culture which seeks to provide an alternative light which demystifies true meaning and obscures true art. The Greeks seek to enter everything. They don't want boundaries. They don't want a transcendent realm which is beyond. The Greeks sought not only to conquer every single country and make a great empire, but to penetrate every single culture and bring it into Hellenization. That's a clear fact from a historical perspective. And this is the deeper meaning of their efforts to penetrate walls. Ufartzu chomos medali, they sought to breach the Beis HaMikdash walls, specifically the Sirug, we're taught, the wall which separated where Gentile and Jew situated in the Beis HaMikdash. They sought to break down the wall of this Jewish, holy, rarefied domain. And I would argue this is the understanding of the words of the Rambam. When the Rambam in Hilchos Chanukah, in articulating what was so horrible about Yavan, he says, among other things, Pashtu yadam b'monam b'noseyam. They stretched their hand upon our daughters and our money. Rambam fixates on the stretching of the hand, right? They don't want anything Jewish to be beyond their domination. The idea here is not plundering money and plundering young women per se, right? It's Pashtu Yadam, it's stretching their hand. We don't want any domain which is beyond us. We don't want a domain which is beyond. And that is why the great battle between Klal Yisrael and Yavan is really over the bias, over the realm of inwardness, the Beis HaMikdash, which had to experience a Chanukah, a rededication, the Beis HaMikdash as in a bias, right, an inner sanctum of Kedusha. Or think about the menorah, which, till this very day, which is Nerush Ubeiso. It's a mitzvah of the home. We perform the mitzvah of menorah as a household unit. Strictly speaking, from halach perspective, it's one ner per household, right? And there are indications in Tosus and Sukkah that the mitzvah of menorah also depends upon a physical home. If a person would chalila be homeless on a park bench outside, they would not have a chiv menorah, because it's a mitzvah of the bias. What it symbolizes is the affirming of biashood, of inwardness. Bias means not only home, but as we see in the pasuk of mi bias u'michutz, inwardness. There's a notion of something inward, something which is beyond, something which is neshamadik, right? Chanukah is a holiday of shemona, of 8 days, milashon shemen, oil, which is the same osia shemona as neshama. It's around, there's a role of soul, which is beyond quantification. And there are other indicators of the bias role in terms of Hanukkah. Famous medrash that they outlawed Jews from putting up mezuzahs, and they actually said, no doors on homes. So this way you won't have a mitzvah of mezuzah. Right? They're trying to undermine the sacred element of the bias, that from the very threshold of the home, it is this rarefied divine zone with a mezuzah. It's all about this issue and this struggle. And very powerful from this perspective to appreciate and understand that the sugyas of Ner Chanukah are cited in the Gemara in the context of Ner Shabbos, right? Perek B'mem Adlikin intersperses and really compares and contrasts the halachos of Shabbos candles and the halachos of Shabbos candles. Chanukah candles and Shabbos candles. Shabbos candles are, of course, there for the purpose of Shalom Bayis, right? Shalom Bayis, family life. The Ner is inherently there to celebrate Shalom Bayis. And it's interspersing Ner Chanukah, I would argue, to bring out everything Ner Shabbos is about, is really what Ner Chanukah is about also. Part of the irony of Ner Chanukah is, unlike the Ner Shabbos, which is situated in the bias, the Ner Chanukah is put al Pesach Beis Umibachutz outside. It's a mitzvah of bias placed outside to show that the bias penetrates the outside world too. That when there is a sacred zone called Penimius, then the outside world is elevated by it too. So long as we are allowed to do our thing and Torah is allowed to maintain its mystery, the whole world is elevated by the special spirituality of the Jews. The world will be forever elevated by the Jewish people and their Torah. So long as they allow us to be an Am Levadat and do our thing, they won't get us, they won't understand us, but they will be elevated by us. And that is the symbolism of placing the Ner Chanukah, corresponding to the Ner Shabbos, Al Pesach Beisum Mibachutz, outside. And the Ner Chanukah introduces concepts of Hidur, Mahadran, beauty. We use the realm of beauty. As the Gemara says, V'yishkan Ba'olei Shein, the Gemara interprets the Pasuk, Yefes, the progenitor of Yavan, can live in the Oel of Shame. So long as it's an Oel of Shame, I maintain it as an Oel of Shame, there's room to incorporate Yefes and beauty and Western thought and Western systemization of things, which we use in our learning process, right? But it is to bring out a realm which is beyond, not to corrupt it. And ultimately, when the Gemara in the Sugis of Chanukah rules that Ner Shabbos is more important than Ner Chanukah, because Shalom Bayis Adif, it is not only a legalism, but ultimately a determination that Ner Chanukah, the illuminating of the outside, always must remain Tafel, must remain subordinate to Ner Shabbos, to the inner Shalom Bayis, which is where all of it is really at. So I would suggest in this context, or from this perspective, returning to Parshas Vayishlach. This time of year, the Parsha is symbolizing the very notion of penis and inwardness, which Yaakov needs to triumph over. Esav, which is, as we said, the umbrella force of all the four Galus, including Yavan. And Yaakov is really asserting here the very concept that I have penis, I have a realm that really you don't get. And so long as I have that realm, I can be very attractive to you, outside world, and I can elevate you. But you must keep my inner world, my inner realm, sacred. And I would suggest that that is why the violation of his daughter, both his daughter Dina and the corresponding story of Yehudas, which we said is the feminine equivalent of Yehuda HaMakabi, right, is so defining to the story. The notion that there's penis, the notion that there's inwardness. You, Yevanim, when you defile the Jewish women, this is not Mishum Taiva, this is your attempt to defile the inner sanctum of Jewish life. From the beginning of the marriage, it won't be Tzenua and beyond Yavan, right? Pashtu Yadam, as the Rambam sanctum is in Yerki. You're stretching your ugly, sniveling hand. You're not allowing a realm beyond, and particularly specifically a realm of Penimius, a realm of bias, that I would argue the fight of Shimon and Levi against Shechem, the foreshadower of Yavan, is not simply for the sacredness of the Jewish daughter, but for the sacredness of the very concept of Penimius, and how telling from this perspective their words, Hakazona Yasa Sachosenu, should our sister be a harlot, can on one level be read, well, Emor Lachachma Achosiat, Torah is called a sister. We are so close to Torah that she is like our sister. Will we allow our sister, whether physically or whether it's spiritual equivalent to Torah, to be defiled? The Yevanim seek to defile Torah, translate Torah, make Torah their own. Again, appreciating that the story of Dina, like every story in Torah, as a foreshadower of Hanukkah, must contain within it the full scope of the Hanukkah story. And the culture comp and the culture over the battle over the defilement of Torah as much as the battle over the daughters. Trenchant read, Hakazona Yeah Esachosenu, and especially if you appreciate in Pashiurim when we've studied that Shemen itself, or Ner itself, can be seen as a symbol for Jewish married life, right? We quoted, this was a precious find. We found the Gemara in Gittin. Gemara in Gittin, I believe it's in Daf Nun Ches, which speaks about Shnei Psilos Ben Aracha, two wicks in oil. That's how it described adultery. There are two wicks in oil, a rather graphic mashal, that the wick is the male, the oil is the female, right? Two wicks would be adultery. It's, of course, physically graphic in terms of the act, but there's a deeper spiritual meaning as well. In many sources, we are taught that a woman occupies the practical role in life to a large degree. She's very tethered to earth and pragmatism. A man can be more abstract, at times more creative, at times more floaty and quixotic and lose himself too. Well, the oil, the fuel, is the chomer, is the gashmius force, but that in turn produces, through the psila, that in turn produces the ar, which is more abstract. And what this represents is ish and isha, chomer and tzura, physicality and creativity coming together to create ar, and that therein lies the power, by the way, of the Ner Shabbos being Shalom Bayis. It is a simile for the union itself of Ish V'Isha. And really you could interpret on in a similar but slightly variant note, the concept of R, of that which is a visual, right, which has a certain correspondence to the world of Yavan, and that is the masculine world of externality, the Psila, which is most immediately producing the R, but it is fueled by a shaman. It is fueled by a shaman, which is in a realm which is beyond Yavan. The Pach, Shahayamunach, Bachasma, Shakon, Kadal, the purity of the oil, is the purity of Pnimius, the purity of Bais, the purity of Isha, which is empowering the R and that which is visual and that which is external. The R on the psila is beautiful. It is the psila, it is the wick, which is above the surface with its R. But it can only produce light because there is oil, because there is the Isha, there is the facilitator. In all of its purity, in the Pach Shemen, which is totally pure, below. And there are other correlations in this between Isha and Pach Shemen, woman and Pach Shemen. We've traced in the past the Lashon Pach Bechos Moshe Kohen Gadol with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, how that is similar to the term describing the purity of Jewish women and their tznias, the pasuk in Shir Hashem Ma'ain Chasum. They are called a reservoir with a chasima, that same term of Chasma Shal Kohen Gadol. All in all, the many correlations come together, and the Shalom Bayis correlation, the Ner itself, the man and the woman, right? As we're tracing it, that the Pach Shemen, on one hand, represents Torah, Kiner Mitzvah Torah are throughout Chazal and Sefer HaKadoshim. On the other hand, we're suggesting represents the woman because they are one of the same. Hakazona Yeyaseh Sachoseinu. Woman and Torah are like are this realm of Pnimius and sensitize us to that realm of Pnimius, which is what the Greeks have no regard for. They are an ultra-masculine, an ultra-external culture, and we too utilize externality, but an externality which is tethered to that which is internal, that which is lebifnim. And this now brings us to the final dimension of the shir, and that is the pach. Yaakov was attacked by Sarah Shalesov, specifically when he was looking for a pach. And then we trace the perfect pattern. When the Sarah Shalesov attacks him in the yerach, in the thigh, this is seen as Dor Shel Shema, the Hanukkah story, right? Well, beyond simply a word simile, pach and pach, pach for jug in the Yaakov story, Pach and Ketanim, and Pach Shemen. What is the deeper meaning? Pach is a jug. It connotes a vessel. It connotes that which is visual and external, but contains something inside. Something which you can't see when it's in the vessel. That is the Jewish attitude towards externality. We have something visible too. We are also successful on the world stage. But all of our chitzonius is always a pach, is always a vessel for something inside. And how powerful from this perspective when you understand that when Yaakov in this very story went back to find the pach of Ketanim, Chazal say, this is a lesson about Jewish attitude towards materialism. A shocking statement of Chazal. Yaakov put his life in danger to find jugs. Tzadikim chavivin aleihem emonim yoser migufim. Their money is even more beloved than their bodies because their money is holy. Now that's a difficult Chazal which requires its own shir. But the very notion that Jewish money is holy and that there is a sacred dimension to that which is most physical and material, how meaningful that that is emerging in Pachim Ketanim. Yaakov is looking for Pachim Ketanim because the Pach is the very notion of that which seems to be shallow, external. No, there's a Pnimius. Jewish money and all of Jewish life is a Pach. Jewish money, see how all Mammon Shel Yisrael, Jewish materialism when done appropriately, is symbolized. And it's Chavivus, is symbolized by Yaakov's Pach and Ketanim, the notion that it's a Pach. Well, that is exactly what the Pach of the Pach Shemen was all about. There is something rarefied inside this Pach, B'chos Moshel Kohen Gadol. You guys have no access to it and may never have an access to it. And perhaps in subsequent shiurim, we'll explore other of these themes and the role of Jewish money in the story of Hanukkah and what that has to do with Hanukkah presents and Hanukkah gelt. A lot of exciting things from this perspective. But if nothing else, we're walking away with the clarity of understanding. Parshas Vayishlach. It's no coincidence that it surfaces this time of year when we Jews are preparing for Hanukkah, buying our Hanukkah svarim, buying Hanukkah gifts for the kids, pulling out our Hanukkah svarim, the yofi, the beauty, the magnificence of Torah, Hanukkah parsha, and how it lays bare what this struggle with Yavin is all about. Live a good physical life. Don't be self-effacing. Get out there. Do great things with the appreciation that the meaning of what a Jew is doing can't really be understood. There's a magic to it. I remembered I commemorated a bit my Rabbi Yerub Ezra, who so many people are mourning, who would always teach students that there's a world of pnimius, there's a world of inwardness that no one else understands. He would always talk about the Adam as an individual, and he would encourage Talmidim to take walks, private walks with no music, no other people around them, think about themselves and think about their life as, in a sense, almost like davening, but not davening to Hashem, meditating about yourself. Because we are people of pnimius. And what, this is an idea the world is thirsting for in a world which speaks of mindfulness and the like. People know they need it, and all the hubbub of a technology revolution and now an AI revolution, all valid tools. But when it's only tools, when it's the Pach without the pnimius, right? Well, where does that leave us? We're thirsting for inwardness. This Hanukkah, and in the preparation for it, beginning with Parshas Vayishlach, let's learn the secret of living with pnimius amidst chitzonius. Thank you very much.